We made it up to slide 15 last time, but I didn't talk much about slide 15 other than to tell you that proteins, which we're now in the section 4 in this chapter, have a huge variety of functions. Proteins are involved in every important process in some way or another that a cell undergoes. They do all the important things, pretty much, almost all the important things, which is why I keep saying that they give you, or any organism, its specific traits, because the proteins are directly involved. Now, your genes, though, determine what proteins you're able to build, so that's why your genes indirectly give you your traits. This table, though, lists quite a few different categories of functions, and each category has many different examples in it. I'm not going to read every word of this to you, but let's just go through these quickly to see how different each function is compared to the others. So there's not only a big range of functions, but a widely different range. Many of your proteins operate as enzymes, and actually a huge fraction of your overall proteins. Your overall proteins is the number of proteins that you're able to make is called your proteome. That corresponds to what's called your genome. Your genome is your entire DNA library. And so your genome determines your proteome, right? Because you can't build proteins without the instructions. But anyway, do you have a feel for how many human genes there are? We didn't really have any idea until 2000, I think, was the Human Genome Project. We finally answered the question. And it ended up being fewer than we thought. Well, that has to do with 23 different kinds of chromosomes, which we'll get into. But there are roughly 20,000 different genes. And we thought it would be much higher for us. So there are roughly 20,000 proteins that you're able to build. Well, a big fraction of that 20,000 is proteins that act as enzymes. And enzymes are examples of catalysts, which we'll talk more about as well. But a catalyst is, that's a word from chemistry. A catalyst is some substance that, without actually being a reactant in a chemical reaction, helps the reaction along. It speeds it up. And typically, at least a million times faster, usually millions of times faster, with the help of a catalyst than without. A catalyst is not necessary for a chemical reaction to occur, but it's not necessarily going to happen anytime soon without the help of a catalyst. And that's one major function of proteins. And the reason that you have to make so many different kinds of enzymes is that each of your thousands of different kinds of chemical reactions that are occurring needs its own specific enzyme for that particular reaction. And that's why a big fraction of your overall genes are devoted to coding for enzymatic proteins. Now, we also have structural proteins, which, just like structural polysaccharides, are there for the purpose of being structures, whether they're rope-like structures to withstand forces or other supporting structures. You see examples for each of these, like silk fibers or collagen in your skin and hair. They're there for the purpose of being structures. There's quite a few structural proteins. Then there are storage proteins, although compared to the other functions here, that's kind of minor, because as we've already discussed, it's better to store nutrients in the form of fat or carbohydrate rather than as proteins. But, for instance, egg white is mostly protein. It's there for the purpose of storing nutrients for the thing that's growing in the egg. There are various kinds of transport proteins, which are all about moving things around. Now that has to do, I mean, that can be movement around your body, for instance, like hemoglobin is an example here. That's a transport protein, one of many plasma proteins that are there in the liquid component of your blood, the plasma, for the purpose of temporarily latching on to something and carrying it from one part of the body to another, like hemoglobin carries oxygen and carbon dioxide, for instance. But there are also transport proteins that act to either allow certain things into cells through the membrane that they wouldn't get through otherwise, or out of the cells, necessary to get certain things into and out of cells in order to remain alive. And if you made a membrane purely out of phospholipids, we'll talk more about this in the membrane chapter, then certain things wouldn't be able to get through either into or out of the cell, and therefore the cell wouldn't be able to be alive. Proteins embedded in that membrane allow for that to happen. There are also many of your, I shouldn't say just yours, because this is about any organism, not just humans, but there are hormonal proteins operating in your body. In other words, hormones that are made out of protein. Hormones in general, recall, are examples of signal molecules. And you might remember me saying that no signal molecule has any effect at all unless and until it binds to some sort of correspondingly shaped receptor. I mentioned it, for instance, when I talked about positive feedback and oxytocin. The body gets oxytocin all around, all over, but most of the body doesn't know it's there because there aren't receptors. Anyway, hormones are just one example of one category of signal molecules, and hormones in general are either protein-based or not protein-based, but most of them are protein-based, like insulin, for instance, is a protein-based hormone. So that's one job of proteins by itself, serving as the signals themselves. But whether the signal is a protein itself or not, the receptor that has to receive that hormone in all cases is proteins. And so that's a separate job. They go together, they work together, but it's totally different proteins and totally different functions. There are also contractile and motor proteins in us animals. Contractile refers to shortening, and this is how your muscles work. Muscles can only pull, they can't push, but they're able to pull because two different categories of proteins interact in such a way that they overlap either more or less, causing shortening when they overlap more. And there are various motor proteins within cells that temporarily latch on to other molecules as cargo that get carried along still other proteins operating as roadways in what we call the cytoskeleton, which we'll revisit in the next chapter. And then last on this list is defensive proteins, which is all about keeping you as a multicellular animal safe from potential invaders. You know, a multicellular organism has to be able to keep track of which cells are part of you and which cells are not part of you and therefore could potentially harm you. Or not even cells, just particles themselves. And this is what antibodies is all about. Antibodies are proteins that recognize specific shapes of foreign material that could harm you, and therefore they get destroyed when the antibodies actually recognize them. So a hugely diverse set of functions. By the way, the reason that proteins are ideally suited to having this many varied functions, or the reasons that they do, is that proteins, compared to the other three categories of macromolecules, and even compared to the other two polymers, remember there's three of those four are polymers, including proteins, proteins by far have the most diversity possible when it comes to shape. And that's because of how they're built, which we're going to get into it right after this slide. But shape is everything when it comes to the function of a protein. Any individual protein functions for some specific purpose. But whatever that function is, it has that specific function because of its specific shape. And proteins, if you were designing them, which is not how natural selection works, but if you were designing them in a laboratory, you could make a protein have pretty much any shape you want because there's so many possibilities. Now, the first on that table's list was enzymes as a function, and slide 16 shows you a cartoon version of how enzymes work in general. Now, this is working to break down a bigger piece into smaller pieces. That's not always true for enzymes. They also are used to build bigger things out of smaller, for instance, or to do other things. But in any case, you have some sort of chemical reaction, and the enzyme is not a reactant, as I said. If it were a reactant, then that means it would get converted into product, right? That's what happens to reactants in chemical reactions. They get turned into a different substance. That's not what happens to a catalyst, though, and enzymes are catalysts. Rather, a catalyst, without being converted into anything, without being used up, help out in some way, speed up the process of the reactants themselves turning into products. And the reactants, if it's a reaction that is catalyzed, which biological reactions are, the reactants are also called substrates. Substrates are the things, the reactants, that bind temporarily to enzymes. The purple thing is the enzyme here. To a specific shape, it's part of the overall shape, which we call the active site, that is just the right shape to receive a specific substrate. This is why you have different enzymes for each of your different reactions. Each one is specific for a substrate. And however that happens, it causes something to occur that makes it more likely for the reaction to occur. In this case, you have sucrose, which is a disaccharide made out of glucose and fructose, bonded together with a glycosidic linkage, that is now going to be broken to break that sucrose back down into the original glucose and fructose. Well, binding to the enzyme makes that more likely, and the glycosidic linkage is broken, then the two products, glucose and fructose, are ejected from the enzyme, and importantly, this is why it's written as a cycle here, a catalyst, which enzymes are, is not reused. I mean, it's not reused in the process, not converted into anything, so it can be reused as long as there's more substrate available. Keep going. Well, now let's look at how these things are built, these things being polypeptides or proteins. Now, at the moment, I just use those two words interchangeably, but in a little bit later today, I'm going to tell you that those two words are not always interchangeable. But anyway, we're going to look at how a polypeptide is built. We're not there yet in slide 17 because this is just a monomer, a single subunit. To build a polymer, you have to hook monomers together, which we did for polysaccharides, right, using monomers called monosaccharides. Well, when we're going to build the polymers that are called polypeptides or proteins, the monomers we're using are amino acids. And here we're looking at a single amino acid, although it's not really a specific amino acid, it just shows you the overall scheme, structural scheme that has to be followed in order for a substance to be classified as an amino acid, right? This isn't a specific amino acid because there's no element called R, right? That stands for something variable. But if something is going to be an amino acid, everything except this R has to be exactly as listed here. To be an amino acid, you have to have a central carbon, the one that's magenta here, the alpha carbon. And as we've already talked about many times, a carbon is tetravalent, so it has to form four bonds. In this case, it's four single bonds. And three of those single bonds have to be with these three specific things. On one side, you have this yellow thing, which even without the label, you should recognize as a carboxyl group at this point. Right? Another one of the bonds has to be with a hydrogen. A third of the single bonds has to be with this group, which you should recognize as the amino group. So the fourth bond, can be with anything, as long as it's one atom or more. It can be any atom. The simplest possibility would be just to hook another hydrogen there. But it can be any single atom or group of atoms. R can be any material. Now, that tells you that it should tell you that there is no limit to the number of possible amino acids, right? since R can be anything and any size. And that's true. If you were in a laboratory creating amino acids, there's infinitely many that you could create. But as we'll see, there's only 20 that organisms use. It's the same set of 20 that all organisms use, which is one compelling bit of evidence pointing to the fact that all organisms are descendants of the original successful lineage of cells, that trunk of the tree that I keep talking about. The fact that we use the same set of 20 amino acids out of infinitely many possible means that we're related. Now, what do we call substances, thinking back to functional groups, that contain a carboxyl group? Well, that's what is in a carboxyl group. I'm saying if a substance contains a carboxyl group, then that substance is what category of substance? What do we call carboxyl-containing compounds? We call them carboxylic acids. And that is the acid part of the phrase amino acid. Right? This has an amino group, but it also has a carboxyl group. So it's an amino acid. The carboxylic acid component comes from the carboxyl-containing aspect of any given amino acid. So every amino acid has everything here exactly in place, but the R can be anything. And the R, therefore, is the only reason why there are different kinds of amino acids. Everything else is identical for every amino acid. Well, let's look at slide 18, which shows you the 20 biological amino acids of infinitely many possible. These are the ones that organisms use. And if you look at the part that is not highlighted in white, that is identical for all of these. That's what defines them as amino acids. Amino, hydrogen, carboxyl, all connected to a central carbon. Same in all 20 of these. The only thing that's different is the highlighted part, which is the R group. And although there's 20 overall, they're put into three major groups depending on the chemical properties of that R group. On the top, they're all nonpolar, and the easiest way for that to happen is if you involve only C's and H's in your R. Because as I've told you, carbon and hydrogen have roughly the same electronegativity, therefore they equally share their electrons. They are nonpolar. The R group makes these amino acids nonpolar. On the other hand, if you involve an OH or an SH or an NH, that's going to make it polar, right? Because oxygen, nitrogen, and sulfur all have higher electronegativities than hydrogen, so it's unequal sharing. That's partially charged, right? Polar. But you can also have fully charged, ionic, in other words. Some of these R groups of the 20 have ions in them, and so those are the electrically charged category, but you could really break that, subdivide the electrically charged into two subdivisions based on whether it's negatively charged, which makes them acidic, or positively charged, which makes them alkaline or basic. Now, the reason this is so important goes back to what I was saying about shape being everything to function. When you build a polypeptide, which we'll look at doing in a second, you're really just stringing together some sequence where each individual amino acid is one of these 20. You have 20 beads to work with, and you can 20 different kinds of beads to work with, and you can string them together in any sequence you want. But after you make that string, which is more or less a linear arrangement, it will fold up into three dimensions based on the chemical characteristics of the R groups, whether they want to be next to each other or not, basically. That's what determines the shape and therefore gives the protein its function, whatever it is. But we'll see that in pictures in a minute. First, though, in 19, let's talk about stringing together amino acids. Well, this should be a familiar process to you at this point. Not with amino acids, but the process of hooking together small things to make bigger things should already be familiar. What kind of reaction does that? Kind of reaction links smaller things into bigger things.
Hydrogen
So did test one not convince you that you have to review this stuff each night rather than waiting for the night before the next test? That's the only way to really have a good chance at an A. Condensation reactions, which are better called what? What's a better word for a condensation reaction?
Dehydration
reaction. Yes, that's how you build bigger things out of small. And remember, that name makes sense, removal of water, dehydration, because one small piece will lose an OH, the other small piece will lose an H, which combine into water that's taken out of the situation, dehydration, linking the two, allowing the linking together of the two. Well, that happens for all the four macromolecule classes, right? We've already been through we've already been through polysaccharides, which are built by linking together monosaccharides. Well, you use dehydration reactions to do that, but the specific bond that's formed between monosaccharides is called what? It's called a glycosidic linkage, right? Remember these? And you use exactly the same kind of reaction, dehydration, to also link a fatty acid to a glycerol if you're making a fat or triglyceride, right? But the bond is called something else. What do we call those bonds? Glycerol is the thing that they're bonded to. The fatty acids are bonded to. We call those ester linkages. And keep in mind that you won't be allowed to look at your notes for the test. That's the key. So same process, but different names for different bonds. Here we have the same process, dehydration, working the same way, but resulting in two amino acids being linked together. And the specific bond we have there between two amino acids is called a peptide bond. Now, if you do this over and over to make a long string of amino acids, you have to have multiple peptide bonds, right, to do that. And that's why the overall strand, the polymer itself, is called a polypeptide. A polypeptide is many amino acids, which are made by linking one more at a time to however many are already there, but each individual pair of amino acids that are next to each other or adjacent are covalently bonded by a peptide bond formed by a dehydration reaction. That's what you're seeing here. Now, temporarily think back, just picture a slide I showed you, because I don't want to go back that far in the chapter here. But if you're working with monosaccharides, remember that linking them together first means that you have to be working with the ringed version of monosaccharides, right? Not the linear version. But what I told you at the time is that an individual ringed monosaccharide has multiple H's and OH's to work with, right? And that's why there's multiple choices of places on a monosaccharide that you can make a glycosidic linkage. Which is why, if you're linking together monosaccharides, you can have them end-to-end, non-branching, or you could have them branching, because a single monosaccharide can be glycosidically linked to two different other monosaccharides. That's a branch point, right? That's possible for polysaccharides like glycogen. That's branching. Importantly, though, unlike polysaccharides, polypeptides are not branched. And that's because, unlike polysaccharides, or unlike monosaccharides, amino acids are subunits that have only one way of connecting to another amino acid subunit. There's not multiple choices. Every peptide bond is made exactly the same way. It hooks the carboxyl side of one amino acid to the amino group of the next amino acid. That's the only way. And since, by definition of being an amino acid, each amino acid has one amino on one side and one carboxyl on the other side, there's only one way to do this. kind of like those plastic bead-like toys for babies. I don't know whether they still make them or not because I don't have any kids. But you hook them together. There's a male on one side and a female on the other, and you hook them together. There's only one way to do that. You can't branch them. That's like how polypeptides are built. Okay, now that's an individual peptide bond, but when you're doing this many times, you have a polypeptide named for the bonds rather than the monomers. And importantly, the peptide bonds are the only thing holding the polypeptide together as a polymer. The R groups, which are the only thing making different amino acids different from each other, are not at all connected to each other. They're just hanging off of this chain made by peptide bonds. The peptide bonds involve only the invariable parts of the amino acid. The variable part is the R group, and it's just hanging off to the side. All right, that's the so-called side chain. Whatever the sequence of R groups is different for each polypeptide, because you can use whatever sequence of amino acids you want. They're all hooked together the same way. All right, now, 20 shows you two different ways that we can depict a polypeptide. A polypeptide, though, is a sequence of amino acids. However long depends on the polypeptide. But a single polypeptide is one specific length of amino acids, however many long. It does not branch because of what I just said. And therefore, it's often depicted, as we see on the left here, as a ribbon. Now, the space-filling model shows you individual atoms. It's nice that we're able to do this with computers. It kind of gives you an idea of shape. But I like the ribbon models because it reminds you of the fact that this is one polypeptide that has two ends. Might not be able to find the other end easily, but like a true ribbon, it has two ends, right? And it doesn't branch. But you don't keep a ribbon just stretched out. You can bunch it up into a certain three-dimensional shape. That's exactly what polypeptides do to give the shape that allows for whatever the function is that that protein has. The yellow things don't bother with right now. Those are disulfide bridges that I'll describe a little bit later in a different slide. The point here, though, is that this single polypeptide, which is a specific sequence of amino acids, takes on a specific shape, in this case, allowing it to operate as an enzyme. This lysozyme is a version of an enzyme. And this is the part, the active site, where the substrate for this allows it to bind. Much the same thing is shown in 21, although this is two different proteins showing interactions between proteins that are from different entities. Not different organisms, because a virus isn't an organism, but a human antibody has a specific shape here that recognizes the corresponding shape of a foreign body, a virus, a flu virus. This is how a flu vaccine or any other vaccine works. The vaccine tells the body, make a bunch of copies of this particular antibody that has just the right shape to recognize this specific invader, so that if you actually are exposed to it, you'll have an army of antibodies on hand to destroy it. Now to 22. This slide shows you four levels of protein structure. As you can see, they are labeled primary, secondary, tertiary, quaternary. That just means first, second, third, and fourth levels. And here's where I have to tell you that the words polypeptide and protein, which I earlier kind of used interchangeably, are not always interchangeable terms. They can be, but they don't have to be, and it depends on the case. So let me distinguish the two. Polypeptide always refers to a single sequence of amino acids, however long. It is one ribbon in the ribbon model. It has two ends, and it does not branch. That's what polypeptide always means. Now, there are some proteins that contain just one polypeptide. That's all the protein is one polypeptide. And if that's true, then the words polypeptide and protein do mean the same thing. They're interchangeable in that case, right? Because that's all there is to the protein. But then there are some more complex proteins that are made of two or more polypeptides complexed together. And in that case, the word polypeptide and protein do not mean the same thing. In that case, polypeptide is just a part of the protein. But notice that even in that case, polypeptide still refers to a single sequence of amino acids. Okay, this will become more clear, hopefully, when we get to the to a quaternary structure. But let's start with primary structure. Every protein, regardless of whether it is one or more polypeptides big, every protein has at least the first three levels of structure: primary, secondary, and tertiary. Primary structure refers simply to the specific amino acid sequence of a single polypeptide. All right, so first of all, you're talking about a single polypeptide, whether it's the entire protein or just part of the protein. Primary structure refers to one ribbon. And any given ribbon is so many amino acids long, that's part of it, of primary structure, how many amino acids there are, in other words, but also which specific one of the 20 choices occupies each position. This is just an example: glycine, proline, threonine, and so on. Those are just abbreviations for the 20 amino acids. That's all primary structure is. And if you think about building this thing, which really happens in the cell, there's two things you need to know. How many do I use? What's the overall length? And which of the 20 do I use in each position? Those two things alone give me primary structure. And that's the information that comes in directly from your genes, by the way. The primary structure for building it. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry, you said it's how many, general two principles of the primary, it's how many and which are used, not where they're placed.
No.
In the ribbon?
No, which are used in which in each position. So yes, where they are placed.
Which and where and how many.
Yes.
Got it. Thank you.
But I was using which and where as one thing.
Yeah.
So the important thing about primary structure is that all of the higher levels of structure, secondary and beyond, are consequences of the specific primary structure. What the sequence of amino acids is going to determine how this ribbon folds up into a three-dimensional shape, and therefore either function well or not so well to do whatever job the protein has. All right, so primary structure is truly important. Secondary structure refers not to an overall shape of a polypeptide, but part of its shape. Secondary structure refers to whether or not, because these don't have to be included, whether or not a polypeptide includes these two often repeated structural motifs, which are called beta-pleated sheets and alpha helices. Helices is the plural of helix, which is a corkscrew shape. A pleated sheet is an accordion shape, folded. And these allow different polypeptides to have variety of functions, so you see them repeated quite often in different kinds of proteins. But secondary structure refers to whether they are there at all, how many there are, and where they are. Okay, that brings us to tertiary structure, which is the overall three-dimensional shape of a single polypeptide. The specific structure, or three-dimensional shape it has when that single ribbon folds up, which depends on what the sequence is. That's why I said that the primary structure determines all the higher levels. Now, if you are a protein that consists of just that one polypeptide, then tertiary structure is as far as it goes. That's why I said every protein has at least the first three levels. But single polypeptide proteins, in which case polypeptide and protein mean the same thing, go only to the tertiary level. Some proteins, though, are more complex. They have at least two, maybe more, polypeptides in them. They are categorized as multimeric proteins. Notice that this is basically the same word, multimer, as polymer, just using a different prefix meaning many. Multi means many, poly means many. But multimeric, even though it means the same as polymeric, means having multiple polymers. Because each individual polypeptide is a polymer, right? And if you have more than one polymer, then you are multimeric. Those are the most complex proteins. And in that case, the word protein and the word polypeptide mean different things. Only multimeric proteins have quaternary structure. They also have primary, secondary, and tertiary, but they have quaternary structure as well. As you can see in the cartoon version, this is a multimeric protein because each of these purple globs is one ribbon by itself. It's one polypeptide per glob, and there are looks like there's at least three here making up the overall protein. So the quaternary structure, which is only for multimeric proteins, is the particular three-dimensional arrangement of multiple constituent polypeptides in a protein that contains at least two polypeptides. Yeah, it's proteins, the only ones this applies to, the only proteins that this term applies to, quaternary structure, are the ones that are made out of two or more ribbons. Now, this is an important thing. When I say that it has two or more polypeptides that are hooked together somehow, that does not mean you take one ribbon and hook it end-to-end with the other ribbon. That will just make a longer single polypeptide, right? So in a multimeric protein, each individual polypeptide remains its own ribbon with two ends and with its own three-dimensional shape, the tertiary structure of that polypeptide. But you have two or more of those hooked together somehow or kept together somehow, making up the overall complex protein, the multimeric protein. No, they don't have to be. As long as they're separate, not necessarily different. They're individual polypeptides, but you could have, and we'll see an example, collagen is made up of three that are identical to each other, but there's three of them, which is more than one. That's what makes it multimeric.
Is there an actual physical connection, or do they just kind of remain within the same space?
There's a chemical affinity somehow that's keeping them together.
We don't know.
Oh, it depends. I'm just using general terms because it depends on the protein.
Okay.
But yeah, there's a reason why they are kept together, chemical reason. Now, speaking of chemical reasons, this 23 applies not only to quaternary multimeric proteins, but also individual polypeptides. I've said a couple times already that the overall shape of a polypeptide, which we just said is its tertiary structure and defines its function, it has that particular shape because of the way it folds up, right? Well, it's not random how it folds up. How it folds up is actually determined. It's determined by the specific sequence of amino acids and what the R groups are of those amino acids. Because if you just allow it, it would be kind of like throwing the ribbon on the floor. If you allow it to just be on its own, it will fold up into a specific three-dimensional shape because of interactions between non-adjacent R groups of amino acids. Non-adjacent means they're not next to each other in the sequence. Okay? So the purple backbone here, the ribbon itself, is the non-variable part holding this together as a sequence. That's the amino group and carboxyl group, amino group, carboxyl group, all the peptide bonds along the entire sequence. Right? That's what's holding it together as a string of beads, more or less. But non-adjacent amino acids means they can be far removed from each other if you stretch this thing out as a line. When you allow it to fold, though, two non-adjacent amino acids can have their R groups come together. And only certain R groups, based on which group they're in, polar, nonpolar, or charged, are going to want to be around those that other R group. That's why any given sequence will fold up into a specific shape that maximizes the affinity relationships between non-adjacent R groups of the amino acids. Does that make sense? We see here that there are four major categories of interactions between these non-adjacent R groups. One of which is one of the identical blues that they stupidly used here, like there weren't any other colors. But this blue one, hydrogen bonds can form. Exactly the same kind of hydrogen bonds we've already talked about, right? Which you get when you have polar molecules coming into play here. Here you have two pieces of the same big molecule coming into contact, but the R groups are polar. So since they're polar, they can interact with each other through hydrogen bonding. That's not a chemical bond, remember. Not nearly strong enough to make it new stuff. But it keeps them together more than it would without being polar. So it stabilizes the structure. It keeps that fold that way and contributes to the overall tertiary structure, the overall shape. What's another name for shape of a protein, by the way? It is conformation. Next, in pink, we have what are called hydrophobic interactions. And notice that here we're dealing with only nonpolar, which usually means nothing but carbons and hydrogens, as in this example. So it might seem like I lied to you earlier because I told you that hydrocarbons in general are nonpolar because carbon and hydrogen have the same electronegativity, more or less, and they therefore share their electrons equally. And you should therefore expect nonpolar pieces to basically ignore each other, not be attracted to each other since they're nonpolar, right? But under perfect circumstances, they actually can be attracted to each other. And I don't want to get too deeply into this, but let me just quickly try to explain why. Just using one CH bond on one part and another CH bond on another part. Each of these is a pair of each bond here, but there's two different amino acids in different parts of the protein involved here. Each of these bonds, though, is a pair of electrons shared, right? Equally shared means they're going to spend equal times around the carbon and the hydrogen, but at any given moment, they're either one place or the other, right? They're not spread out instantaneously. They're either with the carbon or with the hydrogen at any given moment, just spending equal time, though, overall. Well, if you get into the situation that these electrons are moving around in such a way that at the exact moment the electron is with the carbon up here, the electron on the other one is up with the hydrogen, then that for that tiny, tiny fraction of a second is going to make this hydrogen slightly positive and this one slightly negative, right? Because where the electron is makes it negative, where it's not makes it positive. And then the very tiny next moment, it will switch. The electron will be down here with the hydrogen on this top one and with the carbon on the bottom one. That will make this slightly negative and this, I mean, slightly positive and this slightly negative. So they keep switching between positive and negative, this and this. But if they do that in synchrony, then they'll always be very, very slightly attracted to each other. And we call that a hydrophobic interaction because the two things that are attracted to each other are hydrophobic, which is another word for nonpolar. Now, that's very tiny. It's not even as strong as a hydrogen bond, but it's still stronger than nothing. And when you have a hell of a lot of them, they can really add up. This is how certain animals are able to walk on ceilings because of hydrophobic interactions between their feet and the ceiling itself. The strongest one by far shown here is this yellow one. This is called a disulfide bond, and this is exactly what the yellow dashes were in that previous slide I said I would mention later. A disulfide bond is a covalent bond, much stronger than any of the other three. And this happens when you have two R groups, each of which contains a sulfhydryl. If you look at the slide that has all 20 of them listed, you'll see that cysteine has a sulfhydryl in its R group. A sulfhydryl, remember, is SH, just like a hydroxyl, except it's SH instead of OH. Well, if you have one sulfhydryl, and then after it's bent around so they come into contact, another sulfhydryl in a different amino acid. Whoops. Then each of the sulfhydryls will lose its hydrogen, allowing the two sulfurs to get bonded together with a covalent bond. And so that is much stronger and therefore really stabilizes the overall shape of that protein, if they're present. Not all proteins have these, and some proteins have few, and some of them have a lot. There's a lot of these, though, in your hair, for instance, which is why it's such a strong structure. Hairs are strong for their weight and their size. And this is also why if you burn hair, you get that sulfur smell, because there's so many sulfhydryls forming disulfide bridges. That's what the bond's name is, because it's two sulfurs, disulfide.
Why do the hydrogens disappear?
Well, they don't disappear. They just become part of solution.
Okay.
They're in solution, but they allow open holes in the modeling, ball and stick models, for the two sulfurs to be bonded together. All right, now, the fourth one shown here in the other version of the same blue is ionic bonds, which, of course, can form just like they do in salts. If you have oppositely charged ionic R groups, right, one of them is positively charged, one of them is negatively charged, they will be electrostatically attracted just like any ions would be. And that also contributes to the overall shape. So it's not just attractions which are important, but also you have certain R group combinations that would be repulsive, right? Getting two positives together, they wouldn't want to be in that shape. And that's why the overall three-dimensional shape or tertiary structure of the polypeptide really depends on the specific sequence. There's only one way to fold it up so that it maximizes things that want to be next to each other and things that being together, and things that don't want to be next to each other not being next to each other. And that shape determines the function. 24. I told you we had collagen as an example coming up. Now, both of these proteins here, collagen and hemoglobin, just coincidentally are multimeric proteins. Notice that they're made out of multiple polypeptides. But as long as it's two or more, they can be identical copies or different kinds of polypeptides. That's not the point of the slide, though. That's just coincidence. The point of the slide is that proteins in general, whether they're single polypeptides or multiple polypeptides, can be lumped based on their shape, roughly, into two categories. You have fibrous proteins as one category. That's what collagen is an example of, important in animals. You have that in your skin and your hair. Those are fibrous proteins because they're long in one dimension. They act like little strings or ropes. So they're mostly structural proteins, the fibrous proteins. And then the other major category is globular proteins, which are not long in any of the three dimensions. You know, not necessarily, they're not a perfect sphere, of course, but they can have an irregular shape, but they're just a clump rather than a strand. And those have a lot of different functions, like enzymes or transport proteins or so on. Hemoglobin is just an example. Speaking of hemoglobin, though, it's featured in slide 25 as well. This really indicates the importance of primary sequence to shape. So, hemoglobin is a transport protein that's part of blood that serves as a way to carry oxygen and carbon dioxide each temporarily. Picks up carbon dioxide from the cells of the body that are producing the carbon dioxide It delivers oxygen to those cells, and then it takes a ride in the blood to the lungs, where it gets rid of the carbon dioxide so you can exhale it, and picks up new oxygen to make another trip around the body. And each individual hemoglobin molecule, of which there are millions just in one invisible red blood cell, each one, though, is made of four overall polypeptides. Two are identical beta subunits and two identical alpha subunits. Here we're looking at just the beta subunit, which is part of a hemoglobin. And on the left we have normal hemoglobin that functions normally. And we're not looking at even nearly all of the sequence of amino acids here. We're just looking at the first seven. That's why it fades off. Here, don't think that this is only seven amino acids long. I actually don't know how many amino acids are in it, but many more than seven. The first, though, are valine, histidine, leucine, threonine, proline, and glutamic acid, and then another glutamic acid. All right, that's for normal people that have healthy functioning hemoglobin. Well, on the right, we see a person that has sickle cell disease, which is caused by a mutation in the DNA. And remember, the DNA tells you what the sequence is. So a mutation in the DNA tells the body, make this out of this sequence. And notice the first five are correct, but the sixth one, instead of being glutamic acid, is valine. And the cell doesn't know that's wrong. It's obeying the orders it got from RNA, which came from the orders it got from DNA. So it puts down valine instead, and then all of the rest of them are also correct. In other words, this beta subunit differs only by one amino acid. It's like making the same exact necklace except for one bead. But that is enough to make it drastically a different shape, because it folds up based on those affinities of the R groups differently if it doesn't have the same sequence. And that causes sickle cell disease. It's called that because when you have millions of these misshapen hemoglobins, it causes the cell itself to be misshapen into a sickle shape. And each individual hemoglobin molecule is no longer able to do nearly as good a job at carrying oxygen and carbon dioxide, which is why this is a bad thing to have, health-wise. It leads to premature death. We'll use this example for other reasons later when we get into the DNA half of the term. But right now, the importance here is that the primary structure really determines all the other levels and therefore determines the function. 26. Now, what did I just say is another word for the shape of a protein? Conformation. And the conformation can change and does change. Now, the conformation becomes that shape originally, as I've said, because of the specific sequence, because of the primary structure. That's what gives it its shape to begin with. But once that normal shape is taken up, doesn't mean it's going to stay in exactly that same shape, because the environment also can affect the conformation of a protein. It's not just the sequence of amino acids, it's the environmental variables. And there's different things that can affect the shape of proteins. I gave you the two biggies already when we talked about acid precipitation in a different chapter. What did I say were the two big environmental variables that can affect protein conformation? Well, what is it that causes acid rain? What variable? But what variable in the environment? pH, right? pH and temperature are two biggies. They're not the only ones. Can also be presence of chemicals and salinity, for instance, and whatnot. But whatever the variables are, if they change, and it doesn't necessarily take much of a change, especially with pH, then you change the shape of proteins from their normal shape, which you have illustrated by this ribbon on the left, that allows that protein to function for whatever it does, into some other shape. Any change from the normal shape of a polypeptide is called denaturation. But there are degrees of denaturation. If you have a tiny change in a variable, an environmental variable, it might denature just a little bit. Now, even a little denaturation is going to affect the function because it now has a different shape, at least slightly differently, different shape. So usually that means, since natural selection optimizes things, a change in shape is almost always going to mean it's not doing as good a job at whatever it's doing. And if it still can do it at all, it's not doing as good a job. But if it's a drastic enough change, well, let me stick with this non-drastic. If it's a little bit of denaturation, then you can kind of get away with it as long as you restore the variable to its normal value, right? Get the temperature back or the pH back to normal, for instance, and that's what renaturation is. It will assume its normal shape again for the same reasons that it took on that shape to begin with, because of the relationship between the R groups. But if it's a drastic denaturation, if it got too hot, for instance, or pH changed too much, then it's permanent for that polypeptide. It is ruined in terms of doing its job. It will never function again. Now, that doesn't mean it's a totally worthless molecule, though. It's made out of amino acids, which are subunits that you can use to build either another version of that same polypeptide or some totally different polypeptide, right? Just like when you disassemble a Lego structure, you don't throw away the individual pieces. You can use them again to build other stuff. But it's never going to function as a complete protein again. That's not going to kill you necessarily, though, unless it's happening to all of the proteins, because you can build an identical copy of this since you have the gene. That's the only reason you were able to build it to begin with, right? You just need to go back to the library, express that gene so that you get the instructions for how to build it again. But that takes energy and time. Now to 27. On 27, we're looking at the situation in which one protein is helping another protein attain its proper shape. Some polypeptides, let's confine it to one polypeptide, will fold up into three dimensions properly just on their own, right off of the assembly line. The assembly line is the ribosome, as we'll see. That's the little molecular machine that actually links together the specific sequence of amino acids to build the polypeptide. Once you have that in place, some polypeptides will just, in the overall cytosol that within the cell, the cytosol is the liquid component of the cytoplasm, in that solution, conditions will be proper for it to just fold up into its shape it should have. But some proteins don't do that on their own. They need help. They need to be sequestered away from the rest of the contents of the cells temporarily to have their own mini-environment within the cell. And that mini-environment is provided by a totally different protein acting as a chaperone, or chaperone protein, or a chaperonin, as they're called, which is more or less a little canister. So this one protein, the chaperonin, is like a hollow canister with an interior into which the brand new polypeptide that hasn't taken on its shape yet is inserted. That will, by keeping it away from the rest of the components of the cell, give it the right environment to fold up properly, in which case it's removed and it can do its job. So it's one protein helping out the shape of another protein. Number 28 is a transition slide, kind of a segue between the protein section of the chapter that we just are finishing and the nucleic acid part, which we're about to start, which is the only one of the four macromolecule categories that we haven't talked about yet, really. They're both involved here, though. And you can see in pictures what I've said many different times to you for different reasons. Your DNA determines the types of proteins that you're able to make, and those proteins then allow for certain things to happen, giving you your traits. But this is a slide that involves both of those major macromolecule classes. DNA is nucleic acid, and it's named for that. It's named that because in a eukaryote, which we're looking at here with a true nucleus, that's where you find the DNA. But what's shown here would be true of a prokaryotic cell as well. It just wouldn't have its own compartment for the DNA. Anyway, DNA is nucleic acid. It's a polymer that contains parts of its overall structure called genes. The genes are like little instruction manuals. The end goal for most genes is to build a protein, a polypeptide. All right? So, more or less, protein-coding genes are instruction manuals for how to build proteins, or how to build polypeptide, I mean. But you have many different genes, and you have a feel for how many genes a human has?
20,000.
It's roughly 20,000. Yeah, it's much fewer, many fewer than we thought originally. But in 2000, I think, is when we finally completed the Human Genome Project, and we knew an actual answer to that. It's far fewer than we thought, but anyway, roughly 20,000 protein-coding genes. Anyway, each individual gene is just part of a big DNA. And you have 23 chromosomes, 23 pieces of DNA in each cell, each of which has many, many genes on it. So the overall genome, as we say, the total amount of DNA in the cell or in the organism, is like a library, which contains a lot of books, of course. The books that we're interested in are the genes, which are instruction manuals for how to build proteins. But they are like non-circulating books in a library, the ones that you're not allowed to take home. You're not allowed to check them out, right? If you're going to use them, you have to use the material while you're in the library. And so if you think about doing this in an actual library, if it's a manual for building something and you're not allowed to take it home, which is where you're going to build it, you're going to have to copy that information down, right? In other words, you're going to have to transcribe it. That's what transcribe means, to rewrite. Well, that's exactly the first step of two major steps in what we call gene expression. When a gene gets expressed, meaning it's used, what happens is that we leave that gene, that manual, in the library, but we copy the information in the form of a new nucleic acid, not DNA, but RNA, specifically messenger RNA, the red thing. That's what transcription is, and that is the only part of gene expression that DNA is directly involved in. If you think back to what I said early on in the term, the two major functions of DNA are, one of those, it was transcription. Okay, that's using the how-to manual for building a protein. But DNA's job is done once you make the copy. You give the manual back to the librarian, gets reshelved. Okay? It doesn't leave the nucleus in the case of a eukaryotic cell. But now you have the information for how to build a protein in the form of another nucleic acid, mRNA, which can then leave the nucleus and meet up with this brown thing, which is a ribosome. That's the molecular machine that actually assembles the polypeptide. It doesn't know how to do that, though, unless RNA tells it how to. So that part in which that part of gene expression in which the protein is actually, the polypeptide is actually strung together, is called translation. DNA is not involved in that. Its job is already done. mRNA tells the ribosome how many amino acids to use and which particular one of the 20 to use in each position. In other words, mRNA gives the ribosome the primary structure to build. That gives you the particular string of beads, this purple one that's emerging, and then based on that particular sequence, it will fold up after translation, after it's already built, it will fold up into a particular shape based on that sequence and the affinity of the R groups. and that's what will actually give it its function. So there's two macromolecule classes involved here in this overall process of gene expression. Let's transition, though, in 29 to the last section of the chapter, which is devoted to nucleic acids. Now, nucleic acids are in all organisms, not just in eukaryotes. They're just named nucleic acids because that's where you find DNA, which is a nucleic acid. You find it in the nucleus of a eukaryotic cell. But all organisms have nucleic acids. Nucleic acids are the third polymer class of the four macromolecules, right? Remember, lipids are not polymers. Polysaccharides are polymers. The name kind of gives that away. That are made by hooking together monomers called monosaccharides. And what are the bonds between those called? Didn't we just go over this about 40 minutes ago? Glycosidic linkages. Yes. If you're building a fat, which is a lipid, you're using ester linkages. But those are not polymers, right? So polysaccharides are polymers. Polypeptides are polymers. That name also gives away that they're polymers, made out of monomers called amino acids. Nucleic acids are also polymers, but you use different monomers to make those. And the monomers that you use to string together to make a nucleic acid are nucleotides. Each individual monomer is a nucleotide. And therefore, another name for a nucleic acid, which is a string of nucleotides, is polynucleotide. That's kind of the better word because the name, once again, shows you that it's a polymer. Right? Polynucleotide, many nucleotides long. We have a tiny example on the left, because this is only four nucleotides long. A DNA, even a small piece of DNA, because not all chromosomes are the same size, but even the smallest DNA is millions of nucleotides long, so they're enormous molecules. And RNAs aren't as big, but they're still many more than four long. But the point here is that any given polynucleotide is an end-to-end arrangement of nucleotides, meaning not branched. Okay, so you had branching possible in polynucleotides. No branching possible in polypeptides because there's only one way to make peptide bonds between amino acids. And similarly, no branching in nucleic acids or polynucleotides because there's only one way to hook together nucleotides to make the polymer. And I'll get back to this hooking them together in a second. Let me first, though, talk about a monomer. I already told you that the monomers are called nucleotides. Each monomer, each single nucleotide, is just one subunit of the polymer. But even though it's a single subunit, a nucleotide actually consists of three parts, as you can see in the center diagram. Okay, so this is a close-up of just one of these four nucleotides making up the nucleic acid. Each individual nucleotide is a nucleotide, chemically speaking, only if all three of these parts are included. There's three components. One of which is a pentose. And what does that word tell you it is?
Sugar.
Tells you it's a sugar, more specifically. Five what?
Carbons.
Right, it's a sugar that contains five carbons. So pentose is not a substance, it's a category of substances, right? There are multiple pentoses. Well, when it comes to building nucleic acids in organisms, even though there are more than two possible pentoses, there are two that are used in real organisms. And those two are shown in the lower right here. Ribose is one, deoxyribose is the other. Now, look at the structural formulae of these and notice that they are almost identical. Each of them contains five carbons. And each of them contains various H's and OH's that are almost identical in the two. The only difference is what's connected to carbon 2 right here. In ribose, it's a hydroxyl OH. But in deoxyribose, it's just a hydrogen. In other words, it's missing that extra oxygen. And that's exactly how deoxyribose got its name. It's ribose without that additional oxygen. So deoxy means without oxygen. Okay, so ribose, deoxyribose. Those are not the only two pentoses, period, but they're the only two that are used to build nucleic acids. So any given nucleotide is either a DNA nucleotide or an RNA nucleotide. DNA stands for deoxyribonucleic acid. RNA stands for ribonucleic acid. That sugar, though, whether it's ribose or deoxyribose, is just one of three components of one subunit, a nucleotide. I mentioned the sugar first because the other two components are both connected to that same sugar, but in different places. Second component is this yellow thing, which you should recognize as a phosphate group. Well, it's labeled, but you should recognize it anyway. All phosphates are the same, so there is no variability with respect to phosphates, other than the number you can connect to them. Okay? But you have to have a phosphate connected to the sugar. And then also connected to the sugar, you have a nitrogenous base. And nitrogenous simply means nitrogen containing. Now, there's all kinds of different nitrogenous bases possible chemically, just like there's an infinite number of amino acids possible. But when it comes to actual organisms building real DNA or RNA, there are five normally occurring nitrogenous bases shown in the upper right here. Cytosine, thymine, uracil, adenine, guanine, each abbreviated with its initial. So that is a source of variety, meaning that's why there are different types of nucleotides. Right? The only reason there are different amino acids back to proteins is that R group, right? Everything else is exactly the same. Well, in a DNA, whether it's DNA or RNA, these two are the same in every position. Every phosphate is already the same, as I just said. But if it's a DNA, many DNA nucleotides long, then every nucleotide will have deoxyribose as the sugar. It's not a mix and match. And if it's RNA, then every nucleotide will use ribose. So the sugar and the phosphate are not a source of variety within a nucleic acid. The only reason within one nucleic acid or polynucleotide that there are different nucleotides is that there are different nitrogenous bases possible. But DNA, there's five overall. DNA uses four of those. RNA uses four, but it's not the same four. DNA uses cytosine, thymine, adenine, and guanine. The A's, T's, C's, and G's that you see maybe, that's the source of the movie Gattaca. It's just a combination of A, T, C, and G. Instead of thymine, though, which you find in DNA, RNA uses uracil. So cytosine, uracil, adenine, and guanine in RNA. Okay? Now, that is important because both of these, RNA and DNA, are informational molecules. They're carrying information. The information itself is really just the specific sequence of A's, C's, T's, and G's for DNA, or A's, C's, U's, and G's for RNA. If you didn't have that specific sequence, you wouldn't have the information. And that's why it's important to hold the whole thing together as a sequence nicely, meaning hard to break apart. Okay? Well, the only thing that holds together nucleotides in a sequence to form a polynucleotide is the sugar and the phosphates, not the nitrogenous bases. The phosphate of one nucleotide will be bonded to the sugar of the next nucleotide, and its phosphate will be connected to the sugar of the next nucleotide, and so on. The only two parts of each nucleotide that are involved are the sugar and the phosphate, and that's why this whole sequence is called the sugar-phosphate backbone. The only thing that holds it together, and those are strong covalent bonds, which is important because if you broke them, which wouldn't be easy for a covalent bond, you would lose all the information. It would be like dropping a box back when they used to use the typesetting for newspapers, right? You drop that box on the floor, all the information is lost. Well, if you break these sugar phosphate bonds, you lose the information. The nitrogenous bases, though, that sequence is the information, and they just hang off, just like the R groups of a polypeptide. They don't hold it together at all. Okay, I've got to end there.